Chapter 7. The Spiritual Symbolism and Significance of Sexuality. Everything we do, whether it comes from our innate, natural God self, or from our less than perfect humanity, has a deep spiritual significance. In fact, all our experiences have a symbolic aspect in which there is a wider, deeper, fuller meaning, and so it is with sexuality. So what is the point of the sexual force? In the most basic sense, it's an expression of consciousness that is reaching out for fusion. And fusion, which we might also refer to as integration, unification, or oneness, it's why we're here. It's the entire point of creation. Call it what you will, the main goal for all of us split-off beings is to reunite our separated aspects of the one great big consciousness and become whole again. And there is a great big force motivating each and every one of us to move in that all-is-one direction. The pull of this force, well, it's downright irresistible. If we want to get a taste of what spiritual bliss, oneness, and timelessness are like, we can find it in the power of sexuality. For it is in the sexual experience that we break through the confines of time and separateness in which our brains have bound us. In that moment, we are reminded of our true eternal existence. When this happens, when two people are able to enjoy sexual union on all levels of their being, the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual, the sexual experience will feel complete, enriching, fulfilling, joyful, nourishing, and sustaining. This requires that each individual brings a certain level of personal unification to the party. Then, in that blissful moment of union between these two souls, each will transcend their own personal satisfaction. Accordingly, they will be fulfilling a great task in the universe. This may seem strange, given the way we tend to think of tasks as requiring arduous work and often as being unpleasant. In reality, the more complete the ecstasy, the more creative power gets added to the universal pot of joy. Every time this happens, it's like a new star lighting up somewhere, adding another torch in the darkness of the void that we are destined to fill. So, what's the deeper meaning of the sexual experience? What does the urge to unite physically with another signify? Sure, there's the need to propagate the species, and yeah, there's a genuine need for pleasure, but these are only partial answers, and fairly superficial at that. When we are attracted to someone, there is a yearning to know the other. There is a desire to reveal oneself to the other, to let ourselves be known and found. And we want to find the true being of the other. It is this revealing of ourselves that allows us to enter the full dimension of the other person's self, who is also seeking to know us. There is an involuntary force that energizes this mutual desire and creates an electrifying, blissful feeling and longing. If this attraction stops short at the physical level, without the other levels coming into play, at least to some degree, the sexual experience is going to fall short. It will only be an itty-bitty fraction of what the soul truly longs for, but is too blind or immature to go after. Because full union with another soul requires doing some personal housework to clean up distortions and unify split-off aspects. Instead, what usually happens is that we grope in the dark, not attracted to the other actual person, but to a fabricated image in our mind of what the other should be in order to make us happy. The real person, then, is totally ignored and blindly denied. To top this off, we get angry when the illusion doesn't come true. Usually, both parties are equally adept at playing this game, but they don't know it. We can use our measure of fulfillment as a good gauge of how much we are seeking the real person. No bliss? Probably not so real. We're likely superimposing another person, such as one of our parents, over the real person. But if the attraction is genuine and real, we'll want to reveal ourselves in the most intimate and real way. We'll desire the closest connection we can get. This longing for close connection is a bottomless well in our souls, but it looks different for the child than for the adult. For an infant, closeness is totally passive. Babies soak up affection like milk from a breast, which is an embodiment of the feminine "let it happen" principle. The mother, in this case, is the giver. So a woman in the full embodiment of motherhood is expressing the masculine "make it happen" principle. As grown-ups, we can only have closeness if the interaction is mutual. Both people have to reach out, give, sustain, nurture, receive, and take in. There is an organic rhythm that happens here that is spontaneous and self-regulating. This is not a mind thing. Strategy doesn't work. There's an involuntary expression taking place that follows a process that is so exacting, intricate, and meaningful, our wee brains can't even hope to grasp it. Blocking our true fulfillment is the infant remaining inside the adult personality that still wants to have things its own way. It's hungry for a nurturing parent rather than mutual partner. It wants that one-way, all-taken-no-give kind of closeness. Fusion is going to be tough to come by this way. Hence, we trot along the treadmill of perpetual frustration, using our bad luck to justify our caution, withholding, and naysaying attitude. This counter-movement splits off the movement in the direction of closeness, causing a short circuit in the system. And what does that feel like? A stiff arm, an inhibition, a deadness. On the level of our emotions, the movement toward fusion will involve an exchange of feelings. In adult terms, these are feelings of real love in all its many arrays. We use the word love freely, but often without much feeling behind it. Sometimes we even use it as a cover for wanting to exploit or manipulate the other. What then is the vivid and living experience of love? It's the attempt to perceive the varied and complex reality of the other person. To do this, we need to empty ourselves of our own expectations and preoccupations. Then we can let what is be what is. What could be more fascinating? When we no longer have any stake in maintaining a fantasy about who the other person ought to be, and resenting them when they aren't that, we'll be open and empty enough to let in what is. That is one way to express love, and that is a good solid basis on which an exchange of feelings can stand. If we are able to perceive the other in reality, we are free enough of our self-will, pride, and fears to deal sufficiently with what is, including handling pain and frustration if that's what arises. Such maturity is important for the reality of bliss to be able to come to us. This bears repeating. The ability to tolerate pain and frustration are essential to being able to give, receive, and experience bliss. Because if we feel threatened by any hint of pain, the pain of not getting our way, of being hurt a little, of giving up an imaginary or even real advantage, and start to defend ourselves, we will build a hard, impenetrable wall in our energy system. Nothing flows in through this wall, and nothing gets out. As such, we become isolated in our own little self-made prison, built out of our defense against pain and unpleasantness. Confined to such a cell, we become numb and unable to live life fully. That means no fusion and therefore no pleasure. Loving, then, requires that we can perceive reality seeing the other with clean, uncluttered vision. Doing this depends on how well we can suffer pain in an undefended way, without manipulative interpretations. It means letting the other be, and that means more than just accepting where and who they are at this moment. We need to have a vision of the total person, which includes potentials they haven't yet realized. What a great act of love this is, to see another this way. And this has nothing to do with some illusion we manufacture about them being the kind of person who meets our own selfish needs. No, this is giving the one we love the freedom to be who you are. This leads to an exchange of trust. We gain the freedom to assert our own right to be without defiance or by playing games. Such self-assertion stems from a guilt-free state that allows a giving attitude. If you can say yes to wholeheartedly giving, you can also say no. Plus, you can then also say yes to receiving, and there need not be anything childish or neurotic about that. If we won't give of our feelings, a mutual exchange with another will be impossible, since in reality, giving and receiving are one. This also means we can't give to others without giving to ourselves. By the same token, if we withhold from others, we are inevitably withholding from ourselves. But, of course, we turn this around and blame the other for our deprivation. Giving and receiving, being two sides of one coin, are integrally linked. They're not two separate acts. The fusion, along with every single act of loving we hope for and long to receive, can only come about if these are richly flowing out of us. Tenderness, warmth, respect, and seeing the other's potential for growth, change, and goodness, all these aspects of love must come from within if we want them flowing towards us. Add to these patience and giving the other the benefit of the doubt, and make some room for alternative ways of interpreting things. Throw in trust, giving the other space to unfold and just be. Isn't this what we're all yearning for ourselves? Perfect love. Well, that's what it looks like. And we can only experience such love, this fusion on the emotional level, when we're willing to learn to expand our own capacity for giving others these components of perfect love. Beyond this, if we want to roll around in emotional fusion, and therefore total connection, it's equally necessary that we be able to speak our truth, even if the other doesn't want to hear it. To not do so, flying silently under the cloak of loving goodness, is to be sentimental and usually dishonest. We do this merely because we fear the unpleasant consequences and we're not willing to risk pain, exposure, or confrontation by doing the hard work of connecting on a higher and more profound level. In truth, the only way we can communicate openly and honestly in a healthy way without guilt is after we have dealt with and eliminated our own cruelty. But as long as we have cruelty within us, we won't be able to tell the truth without hurting others. This is so because our hidden motives to hurt others unknowingly affects our actions and words, paralyzing our courage to speak up and address a situation that is in need of improvement. So, how do we go about loving in this unhampered way of giving? After all, suppose we're free enough from cruelty that we can speak our mind in a totally constructive way, and still the other gets their feelings hurt. Perhaps they insist on never being criticized or frustrated. Bottom line, we need to be able to deal with the hurt that surfaces in ourselves from such a reaction. If we can do that, we can risk it and battle it through, making it possible to have an open exchange of feelings. If we keep trying, acting from a sincere intention to love and feel more authentically, we'll create more fruitful outcomes by a willingness to risk offending our partner. Conversely, if we speak our truth because we want to slay the other without admitting to our cruelty, Let's face it, it's not going to go well. Let's go back to the basic premise here, which is that fulfillment and bliss, which everyone longs for, can only come about through fusion on all levels with another soul. Experiencing this, though, depends on our ability to take a risk, to confront ourselves and others, and to admit our most guarded secrets. In short, we've got to learn to speak up. Further, we've got to recognize our own limitations in expressing our best feelings, especially if our partner has unexpressed negativity and other hidden games that make this impossible. We need to avoid blame, even as we're casting about to see what the other is doing. It's only when we have no stake in blaming that we can truthfully speak up. Then we won't be too blind to fully see the emotional involvement in a negative exchange. As long as we look away, not wanting to see things as they actually are, our struggles will cause us pain. We won't gain any peace then from recognizing our partner's role in the exchange. Flip side, as soon as we see our partner's negative contribution more clearly, which we can only gain by way of our own self-confrontation and deep honesty, we'll be willing to take a risk, knowing a little pain isn't going to kill us. So, if we want to make the love connection, we're going to need to have honest exchanges at the risk of an occasional crisis. Such honest exchanges depend on each person's self-honesty, along with the goodwill to give up hurtful patterns. Shrinking away from honesty diminishes the bliss quotient. But then you gotta ask yourself, what am I afraid of? Where does fear live in me? Where's the cruelty that makes me afraid to say what I see? Where's the blindness in me that keeps me from wanting to see the other in reality? What keeps me unsure and defensive about what I see, making me militant and hostile? Next up is fusion on the mental channel, the level of the thinking mind. This is the ability to exchange thoughts and ideas, risking disagreement and disapproval. For sure, there needs to be a certain blend of compatibility for this to happen. Two compatible people sharing certain basic ideas about life. And spiritually, they will need to be on the same plane of development. Now, this doesn't mean that every little iota of everything needs to be shared. That's not possible and not necessary. Some variety adds a bit of spice, and of course, divergence is key for further development. So, what are the qualities required for doing a mind meld? One is needing to grow toward a truthful understanding of each other. Another is the willingness and humility to pitch any ideas or opinions that need letting go of. That, and being able to be wrong. It's all about the search for truth as we endeavor to reach deeper union on the mental level. It's not so much the differences that are the main point, but our attitudes about them. That's what matters. Do we avoid discussing our ideas because we don't want to make waves? Do we agree as a way to keep the peace, claiming it's not that important anyway? Can we not be bothered to think deeply about things that aren't all about us? Are we secretly insisting on being right for the sake of being right? Do we pick fights over opinions so we have an outlet for a pent-up tongue-lashing rather than a constructive conversation? We only have the freedom to have different ideas if we are both anchored and aimed in the direction of spiritual truth. With truth as the mission, everyone is pointed in the same direction. Because ultimately, there is only one truth. We can apply this to the whopper issues in our lives as easily as to everyday inanities. But we must also keep in mind that truth has many facets, including apparent opposites that are parts of one whole. Nonetheless, setting truth in our crosshairs keeps us sitting lightly in the saddle of thoughts and opinions, allowing us to share them freely. Such aiming for the inner truth, the spiritual truth, will let little disagreements and differences of opinion slip away, First, they will cease to matter. Then they'll become fused in the spirit of truth that is all uniting. It's important not to neglect mental sharing. Strangely, in a world that emphasizes the value of intellect, it's not uncommon for couples to share themselves sexually and, to a degree, emotionally, but fall far short on mental sharing. Yet, day in and day out, people live side by side with each other, depriving each other of the joy of mental fusion. We don't expose our innermost selves, including our ideas, beliefs, dreams, fears, yearnings, insecurities, and hopes. This is all part of our inner landscape and an integral part of what we can share. We simply can't keep any aspects of ourselves isolated and then hope to fuse with another person in a profoundly satisfying way. We need to stay in tune with the natural movement toward union. It happens quite often that we attribute frustration to sexual incompatibility, which may have nothing to do with an absence of physical attraction. In fact, it may be cropping up from insufficient fusion on any or all of the other levels. Spiritual fusion is a natural result of fusing smoothly on the physical, emotional, and mental levels. If fusion exists on all three levels, the two people involved must be highly developed spiritual beings who are actively working on their spiritual paths. More to the point, a person must have made it their aim to reach their spiritual self if spiritual fusion is to exist. So it stands to reason that the fulfillment and bliss we're all shooting for can happen only to the degree we have advanced in our spiritual development and continue to advance. Forward movement, then, is a given. All too often, people get stuck and have no intention of moving out of their rut. And then they're surprised to find themselves unhappy and alone, blaming life, others, circumstances, and that all-time favorite, bad luck. If we look at relationship through this lens of spiritual reality, we realize that all disputes can be brought into resolution. Because at the level of the spiritual self, we are all already connected. All is one. So by fusing with another with the feeling that there is a spiritual world within both of us in which we can discover our oneness, then spiritual union can happen. The sexual force that is generated through union on all levels has tremendous creative power. It is self-perpetuating. So if we choose to participate in this flow, we will set something in motion that will take on a life of its own, like a stream we need to learn to follow. Also know this, whatever exists in our psyche, both the positive aspects and the negative, is going to show up in our sexual experiences. It is impossible to keep anything out. As such, we can look at our sexual experiences as an infallible indicator of where we are in our inner world. It will reveal where we're already free and living in alignment with divine law. It will also show where destructiveness still resides and where we're stuck and stagnant because something isn't being looked at or dealt with. It is the hidden negative material within that becomes the magnetized minefield, energized by the sexual current which then determines its direction. If there's a negative spin, and this is shamefully denied, the life force is going to go sideways as well. The creative force, which is inherent in the sexual energy, doesn't let sleeping dogs lie. No, everything is going to be woken up eventually, and everything that's hidden is going to come into the light, and some of it might not look so good. So however our sexuality is inclined to show up, it reveals one's attitudes, problems, and impurities, right along with all the glorious aspects that have already come clean. We need to be willing to look at this. What tends to happen is that sexual attitudes are dealt with too glibly by judging them healthy or neurotic, morally right or wrong. but there are keys contained in them that we defiantly refuse to recognize. Instead, we cast our sexual proclivities off as a matter of taste, or as inborn traits, like being born with blue eyes. Labels, we think, take care of the matter. Then the spiritual message from the inner recesses gets overlooked, no matter how loudly it is broadcasting by way of sexual inclinations, whether they are welcomed or repressed. We get confused about owning up to these things without needing to act them out. For example, if character defects twist one's sexual drive into cruel and destructive fantasies, we don't have to act these out to witness their presence. We can still face, understand, accept, and deal with these feelings just as we would any other distortions that arise on our spiritual path, recognizing their inner meaning and disengaging the energetic attachments. There is so much we can learn when we begin to view our sexual energies in this way. We have a powerful, sacred, and efficient tool for growth, with every apparently insignificant attitude appearing symbolically in our sexual expressions and giving us a direct mirror to see what inner aspects we need to be aware of. What does my sexuality reveal about my non-sexual nature? About my attitudes? Where does it expose my problems? How does it reveal my purified nature? So how does all this come together in real life? Let's say we're in a relationship where the attraction on the physical level is good. We feel totally ready to seek fusion there. But we're not so ready to seek fusion on the mental or emotional level. Here, we'd like to keep a healthy distance. In the end, not only will the activity on the physical level eventually be affected, the nature of our sex drive is going to reveal, in some way, shape, or manner, the stuff we'd hope to keep walled off, because sexually speaking, nothing is off limits. If we deny these negativities, the whole sexual experience will become blocked, flat, unsatisfactory, and mechanical. In severe cases, it will become paralyzed. If we lift off the denial, the sexual inclination may show by means of sexual excitement and being cruel. If the guilt associated with this is denied, along with self-punishment, we may be inclined toward being hurt, humiliated, or rejected. The possible ways for all the variances in our psyches to emerge are endless. If we are willing, we can look to our sexual fantasies for clues about our inner aspects. By awakening them and allowing them to be, we can come to understand them. This helps us to re-enliven stagnant sexual energy, bringing it back into its natural, free-flowing state. Along the way, it may be helpful to live out our fantasies, either in our own minds or in a playful way with an intimate partner in an established relationship. There is great opportunity for self-discovery and healing that can happen when we embrace our sexuality and view it from this perspective. Too often, though, people indulge in deviating sexual expressions, enjoying themselves to the degree they can, albeit in a very hampered way. We become unwilling to look more carefully, fearing this means we must give up the only way we know to have pleasure, because we believe this is just the way I am. Not true. The pleasure that would become available could be so much more intense and of a higher quality, and nothing would have to be given up to have it. One simply has to be willing to make the connections between recognized negative traits and the sexual aspects of one's being. From there, the wiring will unwind on its own, naturally and organically, transforming the sexual current. To realize ourselves as complete spiritual beings means total unification, so there can be no splitting off of any part from the others. And yet, until fairly recently, people could not grasp that since being spiritual means to become whole again, the gradual return to oneness, this journey must, by definition, bring sexuality into alignment with spirituality. In days gone by, people would not have been able to wrap their minds around the idea that sexuality and spirituality are linked. Indeed, many still struggle with this. It wasn't known that true spiritual union comes from the union on all levels, which of course can't leave out the physical, sexual. Having across-the-board satisfying relationships, then, is a barometer for the degree of our inner unification. If we can't find union with others, we are in disunity within ourselves. By now, we're catching on to the idea that we've got to start making the connections between cause and effect. That's a big part of what self-confrontation is all about. Our greatest pain in our personalities comes not so much from the split between the levels of our inner selves, but from the gaping divide between cause and effect. Nothing is more painful than suffering from an effect whose cause we ignore. The reason we struggle to unify spirituality with sexuality, even conceptually, is due to the fact that our unhealed issues manifest through our sexual expressions. This led, for many centuries, to teachings that theorized that sexuality hinders our spiritual development. Long, long ago, that may not have been so off target. People, back in the day, were pretty rough around the edges, acting out brutality and bestiality through their sexuality. Not a lot of conscious thought was given to what was happening at that time. People acted with impunity and a heavy dose of self-righteousness. The stronger ones had the rights, and they made no excuses for their behavior. Restraint, discipline, empathy? What's that? In order for spirit to have a fighting chance, such powerful drives needed a lid put on them. So for long periods of time, spiritual exercises were used to harness these instincts. On the one hand, spiritual development proceeded. On the other hand, it temporarily thwarted natural drives. Only now, as we and our fellow human beings witness the unfolding of a new spiritual era, are we strong enough to look at our hidden instincts so we can purify them without danger of acting them out. Be careful here. There's a fine, fine line between safe, honest expression in which we admit negative material and destructively acting it out. Everyone who hopes to walk a spiritual path must learn the all-important art of making this distinction. Yes, this we must do if we hope to unify our total selves, liberating everything by safely bringing out all of it, including the sexual drive, in whatever way it manifests now. The widespread prevalence of low sexual drives and frequent sexual problems cascade from hemming in our negative life force because we didn't know how to deal with it safely. We may have found stagnation or numbness preferable to unfaced inner distortions, but this often results in unbearable yearning that ends up creating more short circuits and unsatisfactory split-off sexual experiences. Stack these various levels on top of each other, and the dissonance between them will surely become apparent. On the emotional level, we might be secretly saying, "I do not want to love," which comes from a part of us hating. But in our brains, perhaps we're saying, "I really should love you. If I don't, I'm bad, and then no pleasure for me. So how about this? I'll force myself to love you." At the same time, another mental level is pushing back with, "You're the bad one. I have no use for you." This is used to cover and explain away the whole not loving thing. Meanwhile, in the physical sexual department, we're saying, "I want to have you, to possess you, so I can have my pleasure." All these crossed wires may result in squelching the sex drive altogether, or it might show up in finding pleasure in giving pain or getting pleasure from denying both the self and the other person. From here, things tend to go from bad to worse, because hateful, selfish, and/or cruel sex will always end up producing guilt. This, of course, will be readily dismissed and rationalized as coming from a prudish or unenlightened attitude, but that doesn't wipe out the guilt, in spite of all the enlightenment that might be bandied about. So if we can't get rid of it by ignoring it, let's take a more direct look at this guilt and where it's coming from. Surely it's got some roots in our concealed hatred and brutality that may come creeping into our sexual expression, whether we admit to having those feelings or not. All our hidden desires to put down our partners, be self-serving, or in some ways not be mindful to them, foul up the sacred nature of sexuality. And make no mistake, sexuality is indeed holy. Also, when we use sex to prop up our weak egos by lusting for power, we produce inexplicable guilt. And then we quickly go about explaining it away as being about our history. Nothing is as dangerous as using this spiritual dynamite in a destructive way, whether in deeds or only in thoughts and attitudes. When hating and a desire to kill get embedded in the sexual energy current, sexuality becomes vicious, going quite against the grain of spirituality. No wonder our forefathers came to the conclusion that sexuality was more bestial than beatific. But that was only due to a millennia of people acting out killer anger through sexual contact. Now we've got something going for us that we didn't have much of back then, a conscience. For the most part, when we're being vicious, we're at least aware of it. We may still do it, but at least now we know it on some level. This can make us reluctant to give in to our sexual drive, knowing that it might bring out our baser nature. When we can admit to our own cruel nature, we have a key to gaining deeper insight into ourselves. Things start to click. Light bulbs go off. By exposing what needs healing to the light of truth, we can discover new ways to activate a sexual power that previously wouldn't turn on a nightlight. So we free our sexuality and at the same time integrate it with our spiritual self. This is an organic, natural process that results from our ability to understand our negative expressions. We've got to develop an awareness of the meaning of our imperfect inner hang-ups, seeing how they efficiently and readily reveal our greed, our cruelty, and our unwillingness to love. This may seem like a lot to deal with, but deal we must. Such accounting is needed on the road to wholeness. If we want to experience everything that the unblocked, revitalizing fusion with another is chalked up to be, we're going to need to give these involuntary forces some room to express themselves. Exploring secret sexual fantasies, once examined in the clear light of truth, will open doors. No truth is ever too much to bear. It won't diminish us. No, it is what we need to wake up. In every creative act, there is an expression of both the masculine and the feminine principles. They are both integral to every living act. In a partnership, the masculine principle is the outgoing movement. It reaches, gives, acts, initiates, and asserts. The feminine principle is the receptive movement. It takes in and nurtures. The masculine principle, in distortion, moves toward hostile aggression. It hits instead of giving and reaching. The feminine principle, in distortion, becomes grabby and grasping. It steals and holds tight, taking without letting go. Both of these principles exist in both men and women, and they show up both in harmony and in distortion. It's not that hard to spot which is showing up where and when. But without both of them, absolutely nothing happens. Creation counts on both. So each of us can begin to tune in to how the masculine and feminine principles are expressing themselves inside of ourselves. We can see their expressions on the mental, emotional, and physical levels if we look for them. Why bother? Because satisfying fusion with a partner is only possible to the degree both principles are working in harmony within each person as well as between them. If there's an imbalance in our souls, this will be complemented by an inevitable distortion in our choice of partner and the way we conduct ourselves with each other. We need harmony if we hope to reach that point of total fusion when the two movements find their zenith. Such a culmination of creation is present in any creative act, from the creation of a planetary system to a simple object. In the total fulfillment of two loving mates, this point of fusion is called orgasm. This creative experience can happen only to the degree we let go of our negativities and our ego's counterproductive defenses. We need to accept, welcome, and follow the involuntary movement, allowing such experiences to continually expand. Eventually, this leads us to total union with the whole of all that is. Until the whole universe has found its completion by having the void filled with spiritual light, orgasm can only be temporary. And so it is that we find ourselves over and over as separate entities striving for fusion. Until one day, when all is one and one is all, then no darkness will need illumination. There will be, once again, only spiritual light, beauty, and truth that will prevail.
This work is copyrighted by Jill Lurie, founder and manager of Finesse LLC, all rights reserved.